Proverbs 26, beginning at verse 1. As snow in summer, and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. As the bird by wandering, as the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. He that sendeth a message by the hand of a fool cutteth off the feet and drinketh damage. The legs of the lame are not equal, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. As he that bindeth a stone in a sling, so is he that giveth honour to a fool. As a thorn goeth up into the hand of a drunkard, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. The great God that formed all things both rewardeth the fool and rewardeth transgressors. As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly. Seest thou a man wise in his own conceit? There is more hope of a fool than of him. The slothful man saith, there is a lion in the way, a lion in the streets. As the door turneth upon his hinges, so doth the slothful upon his bed. The slothful hideth his hand in his bosom. It grieveth him to bring it again to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. As a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceiveth his neighbour and saith, am I not in sport? Where no wood is, there the fire goeth out, but where there is no talebearer, the strife ceaseth. As coals are to burning coals, and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. The words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Burning lips and a wicked heart are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips, and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Whose wicked is covered by deceit, his wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. A lying tongue hateth those that are afflicted by it, and a flattering mouth worketh ruin. Amen. Beloved, if we have learned anything in our series on the tongue so far, it is that the use of the tongue is deadly serious. We must not think, as we're prone to think, that it's only words, because words, as we've seen, carry great power for good or for ill. And as we said also, we shall give account on the last day for every idle word. Moreover, we must not think either that the tongue can't really do much harm because it's such a little member, because we saw also last week that just as little bits and little rudders can turn large horses and huge ships, so the tongue can direct a life and a marriage and a home, a church and a nation. The tongue also has great destructive power, we also saw, like a fire. It all starts with a little spark. It then comes great heat and great danger. It can cover a large area. It can spread rapidly. And then you cannot really restore the area that's been burnt to its original condition. That being said, beloved, about previous sermons, we now want to make a few remarks in general about our text this evening.
verses 6 to 8 of James 3. The first thing we want to note about our text is that our text has absolutely nothing good here to say about the tongue. Everything it says about the tongue is evil. Let's read it together. James 3, verse 6. The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. Every kind of beasts, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed, of mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. There isn't a single good thing in those three verses said about the tongue. Our text, we should also note, focuses on the tongue and the individual. The individual is most prominent in these three verses. Some phrases and some implications and applications of these three verses may be applied to others, of course, but even then it centers in the individual and then goes out to look at others. And then too, the background here is always religious and ethical. James is telling us here about pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father. And he says the tongue has a large part to play in that. The next thing we should notice about our text, verses 6 to 8, and this also in general, that our text contains probably the richest theology and the most vivid imagery anywhere else in the whole Bible. Think about all the statements here made about the tongue. The tongue is a fire. Now, we're not going to say much about that because we covered that in connection with verse 5 last week. The tongue is a fire. It's a world of iniquity. It defiles the whole body. It sets on fire the course of nature. It is set on fire itself by hell. The tongue is untamable. The tongue is an unruly evil. The tongue is full of deadly poison. That's just what the text says. And you see here how the Holy Spirit gives us thoughts and pictures concerning the tongue. Some of those phrases are somewhat mysterious. A world of iniquity. It sets on fire the course of nature. That's mysterious, and we'll explain that later on. Some of the imagery is particularly vivid and bold. The tongue is full of deadly poison. The tongue also is set on fire of hell. That's bold, and that's vivid. And what these three verses do, and especially now verses 6 and 8, is that the tongue here is set forth in terms of various relationships. There's the tongue and sin. How are the two related? There's the tongue and the body. There's the tongue and the cycle of life. There's the tongue and hell. How are they related? There's the tongue and others. And through all this, we see the deadly nature of the tongue, and that the tongue simply cannot be controlled. Of course, how can it be controlled if all these statements about it are true? And remember, we're told explicitly that the tongue is an unruly evil, and that the tongue is untamable. You can tame these animals, but you cannot tame the tongue. That's our subject then. Last week we looked at the little tongue. Now we're going to look at the untamable tongue. We're going to consider first the need to tame the tongue, and then secondly the impossibility of taming the tongue. The untamable tongue, the need to tame it, and then the impossibility of taming it. The first phrase in verse 6, passing by the phrase, the tongue is a fire, as I said, because we looked at it last week. The first phrase in verse 6 about the tongue is that the tongue is a world of iniquity, or a world of unrighteousness. This phrase relates the tongue to sin. Now, since the tongue is a world of iniquity, all kinds of iniquity and unrighteousness are on the tongue. All kinds of it, because it's a world of iniquity. The tongue then sins against God. It sins against the neighbor. The tongue then sins against all 10 of the commandments. It doesn't just sin against the third commandment or the ninth commandment, that of taking God's name in vain and of telling lies. It sins against all the other eight. Sometimes words are as knives. Thou shalt not kill. That's the sixth commandment. Sometimes our words serve as fans. And they stir up and inflame. And they can inflame various lusts. So that someone is tempted to commit adultery or covetousness. And there we've covered the seventh and the tenth commandments. And you could go on. Richard Baxter, one of the Puritans, although he was a hypothetical universalist, lists 30 things about the tongue and the tongue's sins. I'm going to list them for you. Blasphemy, false doctrine, criticizing godliness, making the godly look silly, opposing faithful preaching, profane swearing, perjury, lying, dissembling, boasting, speaking of earthly things at inappropriate times, persuading others to sin, carnal speaking of holy things, slovenly speaking of holy things, dishonoring superiors, despising inferiors, babbling, jesting, filthy speaking, cursing, slandering, backbiting, rash censuring, railing, cheating, false witnessing, false sentencing, flattery, mocking, and then false worship of the true God or idols. The tongue is a world of iniquity, because all kinds of iniquity and unrighteousness are committed by the tongue. Moreover, as a world of iniquity, all kinds of iniquity and unrighteousness are on the tongue abundantly. They're not just there a little bit, but they're there in profusion. Because the world is full of all things. The world is an abundant place. It abounds with its riches. The world is as deep as the sea, a vast abyss. And so the tongue is an unfathomable ocean of every kind of unrighteousness. John Calvin put it like this: the tongue is a slender portion of flesh. The little tongue. It's a slender portion of flesh, but it contains the whole world of iniquity. And no other member of the body is like the tongue in this regard. Not your hand or your ear, not your feet or your eyes. The tongue is a word, a world of iniquity. The question here is, how can this be? How can the tongue be a world of iniquity? And there are various things we should point out here. The tongue is the epitome of the vast world of sin. The tongue is the world in miniature, the world in a small scale, a microcosm, a miniature world of sin. That's the tongue. And so the tongue is the embodiment of all wrong, so that all kinds of evil are committed by the tongue. The tongue utters every wrong emotion and sentiment and thought. The tongue puts every wrong deed into words. And then the tongue does this abundantly, profusely, because it's a world of iniquity. Then we should point out too that the tongue is this microcosm of sin, this little world of iniquity containing all the other aspects of sin. It is this right from our earliest days. We don't have to be taught to use our tongue for sin. This is Psalm 58. They go astray as soon as they be born, speaking lies. There's the tongue, a world of iniquity, even from the earliest days. And the reason for this in part also consists in the words of Jesus in Mark 7. Evil things, first of all, are abundantly in the heart. And out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so the abundant evil in the heart comes out through the mouth and the tongue. And this is what Jesus says in Mark chapter 7. That which cometh out of the man, that defileth the man. For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. That's in the heart, and that comes out through the tongue. The tongue, therefore, as you might expect, is a world of iniquity. It's the first thing about the tongue. James here goes on to say that the tongue also defiles the whole body. First of all, we saw the tongue related to sin. Now we see the tongue related to the body, that which is sitting in your chair. We're not to think in this connection that the tongue here is sinful and that all the other members of the body are not. All the members of the body are used as instruments of sin. We're not to think either that all the members of the body are used for sin independently, so if the right hand's off this way sinning and the left ear's sinning in some other way. The body sins in connection with the other parts of the body. And more particularly, the tongue has a certain leadership role in the sins of the body. The tongue leads the way in sin and leads other body members into sin. In fact, and this will take some thinking, it is hard to think of a sin committed by any part of the body in which the tongue does not assume control. And once the tongue is assuming control, it defiles, or it stains, that's the idea of defiles here, or makes filthy the whole body. The tongue takes the lead and it brings the other members of the body with it. Then again the question arises, how is this so? How do we explain this leadership of the tongue in the sins of the body? And there are various ways of explaining it. The first one is this: think of the body during speech. Now when you speak, your head's involved, your lips are involved, and your mouth is involved. They're already engaged in the act of speaking. And then when someone is speaking, the hands are often involved, and the eyes, looking at the one whom he's addressing. So even as you speak, and we're considering here evil speaking, other parts of the body are already engaged. That's a very simple and obvious way. But yet I think the explanation of the passage doesn't so much even lie in that. It lies more in this. The tongue encourages us to sin in various ways. You're tempted with some evil, you're beginning to back out of it, and then you begin to encourage yourself, you talk to yourself, or someone else talks to you, and then they make you press ahead with the evil deed. And then when you go ahead with the deed, then the other members of the body are engaged. I'll give you an example of the sort of thing that I mean. There's a picture of the harlot in Proverbs chapter 7. The harlot meets the young fool at twilight near her house. She catches him impudently. She kisses him, and she begins to speak with him. And after a while, we read these words: with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattery of her lips, she forced him. And off he goes, the passage tells us, like an ox to the slaughter. Now her tongue, therefore, led to her defiling her whole body, and it also led to his defiling of his whole body. And then we read at the end of the chapter, her house, the harlot's house, is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. The tongue encourages yourself and others to sin, involving the other members of the body, and so defiling them. By the mouth, or tongue, we also can pledge ourselves to sin. This is the admonition of Ecclesiastes 5. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh, or you could say body, to sin. Speaking here of vows and rash oaths, where you swear something you ought not, and then you feel that you've got to do it now, because you've taken an oath upon it. Or another example, in Acts 23 we read of over 40 men who took an oath, calling down the curse of God upon them if they failed to kill the apostle Paul. They were going to kill him. That involves the body. Now they failed in so doing, but their oath, their words, encouraged them to sin. Or think of another scenario, the tongue in boasting about good that has been done. You do something good. The various members of the body are involved in that good work. And then you're tripped up by the devil, and afterwards you begin to glory in yourself and in your work. And thereby your work and the members of your body which were engaged in that work are defiled. The whole thing becomes filthy. Because it's no longer an offering of thanksgiving to God. It's your own stinking good works claiming merit before God. And in that sense, the Apostle Paul says that all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. Sorry, that's Isaiah. But they're all dung. That's Paul. Another argument or way of explaining in which the way in which tongue leads the body to sin is simply this. When you sin with the tongue, you weaken your control over all other parts of the body, so that they too are more inclined to sin. It's a fairly simple argument. Here's Proverbs 17, verse 4. A wicked doer giveth heed to false lips, and a liar giveth ear to a naughty tongue. In this passage, the priority is evil speech. Three times it's mentioned. False lips, a liar, the naughty tongue. And this evil speech goes hand in hand with evil listening. So that the one who engages in false lips, a naughty tongue, and is a liar, gives heed and gives ears to the evil words of others. And that makes sense. If you're speaking sinful things, you're expecting someone else to listen to your sinful things, and then you're going to be more prone to listen to the evil words of somebody else. And then there's a third connection. Evil speaking leads to evil listening, leads to evil doing. A wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. And so what you speak, and what you listen to, and what you do, are all sinful. And the tongue took the lead. These are various ways in which the tongue defiles the whole body. In the way it speaks of sin, in the way it helps plan sin, in the way it defends sin, in the way it continues in sin. And so the tongue can destroy the whole walk that you have with God and ruin your testimony by the evil things that slip out of our mouths. The tongue, beloved, also sets on fire the course of nature. And this relates sin not so much, this relates the tongue not so much to sin or to the body, but tongue here is related to the cycle of life. The course of nature, the tongue is said here to set on fire the course of nature, is literally the wheel of birth. The tongue sets on fire the wheel of birth. It's a rather unusual phrase. A wheel is something which revolves, turns around, and runs. That's a wheel. A wheel of birth, therefore, is a wheel which is set in motion at birth, and then it runs through the whole of life. Wheel speaks of motion, revolving, turning, and birth points to life. A wheel of birth is a wheel set at motion at birth, which runs through the whole of life. So the wheel of birth, or the cycle of life, encompasses all the ups and the downs, the turns of event from your life at birth, to childhood, to adulthood, to old age, and to death. and the tongue sets on fire the cycle of life from birth to death of individuals, of families, and even, by extension, of nations. It sets them on fire. And fire introduces ideas of anger and indignation, of danger, of death, of destruction in homes and in regions. That's what the tongue does. It sets on fire the life cycle. So here's the power of the tongue set forth, in that it destroys a man's whole life, or part of it. And it can even destroy through generations. Things that people say can ruin the lives of other people. If you think for a minute, you'd be able to think of some things that have ruined or damaged your own life or people near to you. I'll give you some examples. I've heard some people even speak of such things. They were cutting words spoken to them by parents or uncles or schoolmates when they were young. And people still struggle with these things years down the line. They still feel hurt and bitter. And this crippled them to some extent and brought destruction and misery. Here's the tongue setting on fire the life cycle of an individual. Or think of family rows. People start to fight. And this can burn for generations. And it all started with some evil, bitter words between your great-great uncle. And then the fight can go on through generations, and people, some ways down the line, don't even know how the fight started, but they know that they hate that other family because the tongue started this fire in the lines of generations. Think too of the moral and religious and doctrinal errors promulgated by the tongue, which take root in an area and burn for decades and generations. To give you an example, think of the tongue of the Pelagian heretic Charles Finney. Now, Charles Finney taught the free will of man in its most bold and offensive form. He preached his heresy all around upstate New York and its environs. And if you were to come back to that area 30 years after he preached, that area was called the burnt out or the burnt over region. And out of that area, the churches went straight downhill with his apostasy because they listened to him and his heresy. And out of that area came a vast number of the cults, some of which you know and are still with us today. They called it the burnt out area. Religiously, it was as if a whole fire covered the area and there was really nothing left but a few smouldering stumps of trees. Generations, because of his tongue, he burnt the thing over. There is an example of a man's tongue setting on fire the cycles of life and generations in uptown New York area with his heresy. Or think too of the tongues of the French philosophes, as they were called in the 18th century. These men taught deism. They taught atheism, because they didn't all hold exactly the same thing. They taught the righteousness of revolution. You overthrow the government, you kill all the priests, and then you take power, fraternity, and liberty, and equality for all men. The rights of man. That's what they taught. A few years later, you had the French Revolution of 1789 and the Reign of Terror. Many people were guillotined, and the civil order was overthrown. Now, we're not condoning the evil magistrates and the evil Roman Church. But we're saying, though, that the tongue of these men brought rebellion and wickedness into the country. And then atheism and unbelieving philosophy took hold and still have hold over that great country for over 200 years through these men. They burned the country religiously. That's the tongue setting on fire the life cycle of individuals and generations. You could put it this way, through their tongues, French society just went up in flames spiritually. That's the power of the tongue. Or to put it in more contemporary terms, you can think of your own tongue to be more personal, as a flame thrower. Flame thrower out of your own mouth. And with this great flame thrower which you carry around with you, you can burn yourself severely. And you can burn others. Just point your mouth towards them, speak at them, and you can burn them.
Grace, this setting on fire, the life cycle and the course of nature, can affect you and others for generations or as long as they live. That's the power of the tongue. The fourth phrase used about the tongue here in James 3 verse 6 is the tongue is set on fire of hell. And now we're relating the tongue not to sin, or not to the body, or not to the life cycle, but to Satan and to hell. The tongue is closely related to them. And here we're explaining a little bit further the flamethrower idea, if we can stick with that picture for a moment. Here we learn about the supply and the resources of the flamethrower which we carry in our own mouths. Here's the resources. Hell. That's where you get your fire from. Hell and the devil. This passage is telling us, when it says the tongue is set on fire of hell, that hell, although we can't see it, hell has a little outcrop, a little toehold in this world. And it has it in the mouths of all people. That's the toehold that hell has in this world. So our tongues then are flamethrowers with limitless resources, as deep as the bowels of hell. That's the fire that comes out of our mouths. So then we can do the devil's work by speaking evil, angry, bitter, cutting words. We can do his work, and we can burn ourselves, and we can burn others around us. Remember too that when we're talking about hell and Satan, because the two go hand in hand, that Satan is especially good at controlling the tongue and guiding us in this direction, because the scriptures tell us that he is a liar from the beginning. Liar and tongue go nicely together. That he is also the accuser of the brethren. There's the tongue again. He is also called the deceiver. That's what the word devil means. So now we're getting at the deepest origin of the wicked tongue. Jesus said, and we quoted this earlier from Mark chapter 7, that the words that come forth out of the mouth that defile a man have as their origin the evil heart. And here James is taking it a step further, and he's saying that it's hell and the devil working through your old nature. So to put it slightly differently, Satan and sin and hell are in our hearts, and we breathe forth fire like some sort of dragon with our evil tongue. That's the picture that James is painting for us about the tongue. This is why, too, hell is such an appropriate destination for all liars and blasphemers and those who use their tongues against the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Hell is the origin of all this evil speech. And then we come full circle. The speech comes out from hell, we speak it, and the speech takes us back to hell. Hell is also, therefore, the judgment, not only the origin, but the judgment for sinful speech. And this is probably why in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man in hell asked Father Abraham, "Father Abraham, send Lazarus that he may dip his finger in water and cool my tongue." Cool my tongue. Psalm 120 speaks of God's judgment on him who uses his tongue evilly as pouring upon him the coals of juniper, hot fire upon the tongue that does evil. Then finally, to look at the fifth phrase, the tongue is full of deadly poison. The tongue and sin, the tongue and the body, the tongue and the life cycle, the tongue and Satan and hell, and now the tongue more especially in connection with others, full of deadly poison. This gives us a second picture of the power of the wicked tongue. You get the picture of fire, the flamethrower or the dragon, shooting fire at others and burning them. And now you have the picture of poison through the tongue, spitting poison at people. It's not one of those poisons that just makes you sick. It's one of these poisons that kills you. It's a deadly poison. And this is a sobering passage. The question is, do we really believe this about the tongue? It's a question of faith. When we talk about faith in Jesus Christ, we also thereby mean faith in the Word of God that reveals to us the mind of Christ. So the question is, do you believe this? Do you believe this power is in you according to your old man? That you breathe forth fire and that you spit poison when you speak evil words? That's the question. And none of us really believe that as we ought. And we pray, Lord, increase our faith. Then we also, to make a doctrinal point, we also note that this means that the whole idea of perfectionism is impossible. You know that idea that Christians in this life can live sinlessly perfect lives? In general, it shows no understanding of the nature and holiness of God, no understanding of God's law, no understanding of sin. But here, in connection with James 3, it shows no understanding of the tongue. Imagine somebody who was so foolish as to think that every word which they spoke was righteous. When James says the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity, it defiles the whole body. It sets on fire the course of nature. It is set on fire of hell. And anybody says, well, I'm sinlessly perfect. I've had the second blessing, so now I'm perfect. It's just an utter fool. This also means, beloved, that free will is impossible. That whole notion that man is able to choose God and do good without God's irresistible grace. You don't have free will, the power to do good without God's irresistible grace, with respect to any spiritual activity or with respect to the activity of any bodily member. And you certainly don't have free will with respect to your tongue. Think of what this says. The tongue is set on fire of hell. The tongue is a world of iniquity. Where is the power or control that the unregenerate man has over his body and over his tongue, with this being the case? And this brings us, in closing, beloved, to consider the impossibility of taming the tongue. James 3 makes it very, very clear that you cannot control the tongue. Look at verse 2. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. But if you can control your tongue, you can control the whole body. Everything will be dead easy. And that implies that you can't tame the tongue. To make it clearer, you can't tame your tongue because it's a fire. It's a world of iniquity. It defiles the whole body. It sets on fire the life cycle. It's set on fire of hell. Verse 8, you can't control the tongue because it is an unruly evil. That is, it is something which can't be held fast and can't be held down. So it's untamable from that perspective too. And then most particularly, verses 7 and 8 bring up the contrast. Every kind of beasts and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind. And then it doesn't say, and just as these animals have been tamed, you can tame your tongue. It doesn't say that. It says, but the tongue can no man tame. So it asks us for a minute to think about the kingdom of beasts. Think of all the beasts that have been tamed. Horses and cats and dogs and elephants even. They can be tamed. You see people riding them in India. Lions. Lions can be tamed because you've heard of a lion tamer. And then think of the birds which can be tamed. Budgies and hens and all sorts of birds. And then serpents.
Well, you've got the snake charmer with his little flute, and up comes the snake. And then you've got things in the sea. You've got dolphins and seals. They can be tamed too. It's quite amazing, isn't it, to think of all those animals that can be tamed in the air, in the fields around us, in the water. Mighty lions and elephants even, they can be tamed. But the point is here that nobody can tame the tongue. Not one person has ever succeeded, apart from, of course, the Son of God. Taming the tongue. You might be tempted to think, though, that you really can tame the tongue. After all, you could just not say anything. Would that not be taming the tongue? Just saying nothing. And there is something to be said for that. One of the Proverbs says that even a fool, when he keeps silence, is counted wise. Sometimes that's the best way to go. You're in the company of people wiser than you. Just keep quiet and people might think, well, at least he must have some wisdom. Because if you speak, you might only let yourself down. But is that all there is to taming the tongue? I think even a natural man could keep his tongue quiet for a few hours or even a day. I think he could do that. But is that taming the tongue? It's not. Taming the tongue isn't just stopping the tongue from doing certain things. It's taming the tongue in order to do certain good things. Just as taming a dog or any other sort of animal doesn't just mean that you stop him from doing certain things that you don't want him to do. You also want to train him and tame him so that he can do certain good things. Like bring in the newspaper from the front door. Then you've got him tamed. So the question is, can a man of himself, outside the grace of God, make the tongue do good? And the answer to that is no, absolutely not. Because the tongue can't be tamed. The tongue's an unruly evil. The tongue is set on fire of hell. So how can the tongue therefore be tamed? Can't. Outside of grace. Now I've spoken about the impossibility of taming the tongue. If I finished at this point, you'd say, well, that man came and told us we were all sinners. He said it was impossible to tame the tongue. May as well not even bother. May as well just let the tongue go there. But that isn't the point either. The point of the text is to show us that we can't do it of ourselves. To tell us that we can do it by grace in another way. To tame something requires force, but we don't have this power of ourselves. It requires skill, and we don't have this understanding. The way to tame the tongue is only by grace. Sovereign, irresistible, particular grace. The grace of the Son of God died for us and who shed his blood. The one who kept his tongue perfectly, tamed it always, who always spoke the words that the Father gave to him. That's our only hope. That grace is received through the preaching of the word, through faith. And when we find ourselves losing control of our tongues, we pray and we ask for help. But don't forget about the things that you've heard. Be convinced in your mind that you can't do it of yourselves, so that you cry out for help. Amen.